This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where we prepare for the horror and the hope. This week you'll hear one of the most important interviews I have ever done with one of the persons that I consider kind of a god of science. For a couple of decades, I've followed the work of V. Ramanathan from the Scripps Institution in California. Ram, as he's known, worked with one of his star postdocs, Yang-Yang Shu, to draw the big picture for us. They gathered up 4 decades of Ram's data collection, starting with his participation in the launch of early climate satellites in the 1980s, rolling through the many planes he had scooping up air over India and China, the ocean boys, the works. The result is as huge as any paper James Hansen has ever done. They find that except for the dimming effect of pollution, the Earth energy has already surpassed 1.9 degrees C above pre-industrial levels. That's well above the danger zone. There is a 1 in 20 probability we will go past 3 degrees C by 2050. That is called catastrophe. And this paper looks even beyond catastrophe into the existential threat of the unknown. Knowing that, the pair calculated what we have to do to save ourselves, and they lay it out in 3 great steps. It's difficult, but not impossible, Ramanathan says, to return to 1.5 degrees of warming by the end of this century. In the second half hour, Professor Andy Ridgewell from the University of California, Riverside, joins us to explore the last time Earth warmed by 5 degrees C in a relatively short time. His new paper says that volcanoes not melting methane caused the event known as the PETM 56 million years ago. Let's go.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. If you are looking for a roadmap for a catastrophic climate future, this is it. You are on that road. But top scientists are working to find a better, safer future. A new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy outlines both the threat and a hope. I've reached the co-author, the distinguished professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in California, Dr. Virabhadran Ramanathan. Dr. Ramanathan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
The title of your new paper is Well Below 2 Degrees C, we'd all like that, Mitigation Strategies for Avoiding Dangerous to Catastrophic Climate Changes. Why did you and lead author Yang-Yang Shu from Texas A&M take on this big paper?
Yeah, I mean, the study took about 3 years to finish. And what we basically did was go back to the data I had collected since the last 35 years. In the early 1980s, I teamed up with NASA to launch a climate satellite, which was, you know, measuring the greenhouse effect directly. And then I'd collected data from ships, from aircraft, from drones, and what have you. When I went back and looked at that data in a series of studies with many of my students, Dr. Shu is also what was my student until 2 years ago. What we found was two disturbing things: that almost everything that was predicted decades ago was coming true. The only exception was that the observed changes were much larger. And we attributed it to feedbacks, complex feedbacks, where many things are pushing the system in the same direction. So that made me realize we need to think about the worst possible consequences, not just the 50% probability value. You know, I think most studies were focusing on the central value of what's going to happen when we increase the greenhouse gases. So when we focused on this low probability, that is about 5 to 10% probability of things happening, we found disturbingly large changes, projected large changes. So then I had to go to the literature of how economists and social scientists call things as catastrophic to existential threat. So we both mapped these types of risk classifications on our data. This is Dr. Shu and myself. And we were sort of forced by the data to call these risks by proper names, and that is there is a 5% probability that in about 30 plus years from now, climate change could become catastrophic. So then you ask, what do we mean by catastrophic? It is in the same sense we call hurricanes as catastrophic. When they hit you, you just don't have time to adapt or to cope with it. Same way, the changes which we are projecting, again, we are projecting to be a 5 to 10% probability of happening. They'll be too fast and too large for many of us to adapt. And the other thing is that many studies are projecting, you know, this so-called catastrophe is when tipping points happen. And one thing I wanted to caution your readers, when I say 5% probability, the tendency to think, why focus on these low probability events? Let's just focus on this 50% probability, which IPCC is focusing on. My response to that is 5% is 1 into 20 odds of what we are saying will happen. We wouldn't, you know, get on a plane with those kind of odds. So 5% probability is not that low a probability. If it happens, it could be disastrous.
So you are the pioneer in the dimming effects of aerosol pollution, like the Asian brown cloud that hangs over northern India and parts of China. Isn't it ironic that if we clean up the air, the Earth could warm even more? Should we be glad we have air pollution for now?
Yeah, that's a good question. Just to clarify that, there are two types of aerosols. One type, you know, which comes from coal combustion, like sulfates, or from your car's nitrates. Yeah, they do have a cooling effect on the planet. But then there are other aerosols, like soot, coming from diesel. They are potent global warming agents. For example, a ton of the soot can have the same warming effect as 2,000 tons of carbon dioxide. That's first. But when you add up all the warming and cooling aerosols together, it is true they are having, you know, a sort of a slight cooling effect. But the flip side of that coin is these same particles kill over 6.5 million people every year from heart disease, blood pressure, cancer, etc. So they are deadly toxic pollutants. The second thing is, while they do have a cooling effect, by dimming, by cutting sunlight going into the ocean, they cut down rainfall. So we, in fact, attributed this 15 years ago, the dimming effect to decrease in the monsoon rainfall. There was quite a bit of skepticism from scientists, particularly scientists from India about this. But now, the government institutions in India, scientists are publishing, yes, the monsoon has slowed down because of this particular pollution. So we're all converging on the same thing. Just to give you one more deadly effect of this soot, Dr. Xu, you know, who was my co-author, this was his PhD thesis. He showed the soot from India and China depositing on the glaciers contributes 50% to the melting of all the glaciers we are seeing in the Tibetan Himalayas. So these, we should not get fooled by the so-called cooling effect of these aerosols.
Well, let's get to the paper where you describe three categories of warming risk from 1.5 degrees to 5 degrees or more. Can you talk about those categories as you outlined them?
Yeah. The global climate community, particularly the United Nations and this UN-organized IPCC, which is a group of over 1,000 scientists, they've already, concluded warming anything beyond 1.5 to 2 degrees is dangerous. So it's called dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. Okay, so that was already there. They have put it at 2 degrees, but we moved it to 1.5. And then the next category, we put from 3 to 5 degrees as catastrophic. We were motivated to call any warming in excess of 3 degrees catastrophic from the following consideration. There was research suggesting that warming in excess of 3 degrees would cause tipping points. You know, things like a major die-down of the Amazon forest or rain system, shifting, disrupting, weather disruptions. And then there was another, you know, what I think was the pivotal study, which made me become bold enough to call it catastrophic and then beyond fires, beyond catastrophic, is the following. They showed that a warming of about 4 degrees would expose 70% of the population. Remember, we are now talking about beyond 2050, the population of around 10 billion. So it'll be 7 billion people would be exposed to deadly heat. And they defined what that means, that if you stay outside for more than several hours, you could die from it. And then there was other studies pointing out when the planet gets warmer than 4 degrees, about 2.5 billion people would be exposed to viruses which are not known in northern countries, you know, chikungunya, dengue, so on, but 26 viruses. So it is this impact on the natural system. And more than that, I was prejudiced by the impact on human beings. So that's what made us think of these three categories.
Now, just before we get to the solutions, and they are very important, did I read this paper correctly in you are saying there is a low risk, but it is possible that we could even reach 3 degrees C warming by 2050?
Yes. It's not a low risk. It's a high risk, but low probability. So high risk, low probability. That is, it has a low probability of happening, about 1/20 chance of we exceeding, hitting 3 degrees in the next 35 years. But it poses high risks in the sense that it could become catastrophic if we allow it to happen.
Well, let's get to some of the brighter news in this paper. You propose 3 levers that humans could pull to veer away from climate disaster. Let's take one at a time. First, what do we need in terms of becoming carbon neutral? What do we have to do to get results, and when?
Well, you know, so there are 3 levers. The first lever is that we go to zero pollution of carbon dioxide, which is what we call carbon neutral. And more than 80% of the carbon emissions comes from fossil fuel combustion, burning of coal, oil, and gas. Interestingly, the solution is extremely simple to say, which is you convert all the end users to electricity, your home heating, your cooking, and your dishwashers, everything, convert to electric appliances. And your cars too, electric cars, and generate electricity using renewables. You've got 5 options. Solar, it'll work. If you're living in the, you know, 40 degrees latitude north to 40 degrees south, there is abundant sunshine. That's where, by the way, 2/3 of the population live. And wind, the northern latitudes, you have wind. And hydropower, California is 25% is hydro. And geothermal. Scandinavians use geothermal heat. And, of course, if nothing else works, nuclear. So we have tremendous options. But I recognize just saying convert all users, end use to electricity looks very simple. It's not that easy, but we are facing catastrophic problems. The difficulties of these solutions pale compared to the catastrophe. And, you know, just to give one more example to you, there is less than a 1 in 1,000,000 chance of your house burning in fire, but we all take fire insurance, right? I'm talking about 1 in 20, not in 1 in 1,000,000. So that is the carbon neutral. And again, one can say, you know, Ramanathan is, you know, his head is in the sky, he's talking about pie in the sky. No, California, San Diego, the city I live in, we have a Republican mayor, and we are going to go carbon neutral for our energy generation in about 15 to 20 years. So the technologies are there. The second thing with the problem in just relying on carbon neutral is that carbon dioxide, once it's in the air, stays for 100 years. So it's going to be slow acting. We need something fast and quick. For that, we need to pull on the second lever. We call it short-lived climate pollutants. There are 4 of them, methane, which comes from natural gas and from cattle, paddy field, etc. and black carbon, which is soot coming from burning wood or burning coal or burning oil. And then there are hydrofluorocarbons, HFCs, used as refrigerants. These refrigerants, a ton of them, when it escapes into the air, has the same effect as 2,000 to 4,000 tons of carbon dioxide. The beauty of these short-lived climate pollutants is that they stay in the air only for weeks to 10 years. So if you pull that lever, their effects are gone within a few weeks to about 10 years, so we can get an immediately cooling effect on the planet. Okay? So the carbon dioxide is hugely difficult. So you use your stronger hand, in my case it's my right hand, to pull the CO2 lever. And with my weaker hand, I pull the short-lived climate pollutant. It's easier. The trick, the key thing is we have to do it now. We can't wait for 10 years. We are running short of time.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith with my distinguished guest, Dr. V. Ramanathan from the Scripps Institution at the University of California. Now, you do talk about a third lever, which we may or may not pull, and that is carbon extraction and sequestration. As far as I know, there is no working CES tech on a commercial scale on the planet today. Can we place any hope in a technology we don't have yet?
It's a good question. So when do we need to pull the third lever? That if the entire world has to do this, so if we start doing it now, let's say it takes 10, 15 years for it to do that. In the meantime, we would have put another 500 billion tons of carbon dioxide in the air. Okay? So we have to take it out. Any delay in mitigating, pulling lever in one and two would cost us trillions of dollars in taking that CO2 toxic pollutant out of the air. And I absolutely agree with you. There is no scalable technology, but our hope is a study like ours, pointing out the catastrophic consequences of inaction, would motivate engineers, technologists, chemists, and biologists to figure out how to take that CO2 out of the air.
I wonder if it's a coincidence that as scientists with Indian and Chinese roots, you two ask the question seldom raised, climate change more dangerous for whom? Tell us why that is so important.
Yeah, I mean, thanks for asking this question. That's the one which is of most immediate concern to me, which is that about 50 to 60% of the pollution is from the wealthiest 1 billion people from around the world. And there are 3 billion people, the poorest 3 billion, they are still burning firewood and dung and anything they can get their hands on to even cook their food. So they're still relying on 18th century technology. So when we face severe droughts, severe floods, storms, sea level rise, the existential threat is going to come to them first. And while I don't know that, I can't predict exactly when that's going to happen, I personally wouldn't be surprised if climate change becomes an existential threat to this 3 billion people in the next 15 to 20 years.
And getting back to the danger of our situation now, you talk about existential threats lurking in this carbon bomb. And does existential imply the possibility of even human extinction if the climate warms above 5 degrees C very quickly?
I mean, we certainly can't rule out. I don't know the entire population, but, you know, billions. Because what we have not talked about yet is independent of climate change scientists, ecologists and paleontologists are pointing out, based on detailed analysis, that there is, you know, a major extinction ongoing just by because of habitat destruction, losing biodiversity, right? Clearing forests, putting our houses, etc. And now on top of that, they are saying climate change could expose 20% to more of the species to extinction. So now you add this exposing humans to deadly heat stress, deadly viruses, sea level going up, with mass population migrating away from, you know, damaged areas, and then you bring in the extinction of species. We rely on them. So we could not but, you know, conclude beyond 5 degrees poses existential threat. But in our classification, we put two question marks. And our expectation and hope is that by bringing this possibility of existential threat out of our closet, most of us, we are worried about this, into the front page, we will do more careful analysis of what does it really mean to our existence. The question is out there, and we felt compelled by the data to bring it up. I don't think natural scientists have thought in these words, or, you know, this is just simply not in my lexicon, as if I'm a physicist. But we had no option but to put this category out there.
You know, one of my concerns is, will we really realize when catastrophe arrives? I mean, we've just seen record hurricanes wiping away Caribbean islands and drowning East Texas. At what point do we say, yes, this is the first stage of catastrophe?
I'm glad you asked that question. Now I'm going to speculate, all right? Based on our paper, we are showing that we are going to exceed the threshold of dangerous climate change, is 1.5 degrees, in another 15 to 20 years. Okay? By then, the changes will be so clear to everyone. Everyone would be impacted. This may be too optimistic, but I'm certainly expecting when we cross that 1.5 degrees, there'll be a hue and cry from every person in the world, including the United States, for immediate action.
Well, I've been waiting for that, and I keep thinking, well, when the Arctic ice melts back, surely everyone will react, but I don't know what it's going to take. I hope you're right. You do say that climate science alone can't just stick to pure physics and atmospheric chemistry. Why do scientists have to include society and social choices now as well when we try and project climate change?
You know, this was an independent report I did 2 years ago from 50 scientists from all 10 campuses of the UC system. We had theologians, we had social scientists, we had political scientists, and we had, of course, climate scientists and engineers. And we said, what are the top 10 solutions which is going to take to get us out of this mess? I was not surprised. I was excited, but I was not surprised when these 50 scientists concluded societal transformation is our solution 2 and 3. Without societal transformation, we are not going to solve this problem. At some point, we have to stop asking about the economics of it, but we start thinking about the common good of destroying people's lives and destroying the planet.
Well, finally, I'd like to ask you something about what I call the paralysis of climate doom. Even reading your paper, by the time I got through the abstract and those helpful introductory boxes, I was so overwhelmed by the awful possibilities, I had trouble concentrating on the solutions you offered. Is there a problem getting solutions going when we are facing such a huge danger?
You know, these were all buried in the last page. The shining bright light in the sky, or the lining in the silver lining in the clouds, is that the climate mitigation train has already left. There are 53 cities around the world embarking on carbon neutrality. There are 65 industries who have started on this, and so I call them living laboratories. And on the front of this group of living laboratories is California and Sweden. You know, both of them have cut down their carbon emissions. Of course, Sweden a lot more, by 20%, compared to California, 6-7% in the last 9 years. As they were doing it, their GDP grew significantly. So that sort of put to rest this nagging worry. Cutting carbon emissions is going to destroy our economy and send more people to poverty houses. No, both countries have flourished. And the second thing is renewable energy is now employing 8.1 million people around the world. And as you know, just last month, China said there will be no more fossil fuel cars after 2040. And China was, you know, preceded by UK and France. And California is going to have at least 2 million electric cars. So things are happening. But I must say, while I'm excited by it, the pace is not fast enough. We have to, you know, really do a lot more drastic action. But we are not starting from zero.
As we wrap up, is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
No, you asked some very, very insightful, pointed questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you. We've been speaking with Dr. V. Ramanathan. He's quite famous in science, a pioneer in research, and a distinguished professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography in California. His latest paper with Yang-Yang Shu from Texas A&M University is Well Below 2 Degrees, Mitigation Strategies for Avoiding Dangerous to Catastrophic Climate Changes. It is a must-read, and the authors have made sure you can access it for free in full, as published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Find links to all this in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Dr. Ramanathan, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
You're most welcome. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. A best of Radio EcoShock replay. When it comes to rapid global warming, the best example we have happened around 56 million years ago. The planet warmed up around 5 degrees C in less than 5,000 years, which is very fast in geologic time. To know what can happen now, we badly need to find out about a rapid warming event called the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum, or PETM. With no humans burning fossil fuels, what happened? The best guess was that frozen methane on the seafloor reached a tipping point and came burping up into the atmosphere as major warming gases. That was the story I accepted, until a revolutionary new paper was published in the journal Nature on August 30, 2017. We've reached a co-author of that paper, Dr. Andy Ridgewell. He's a former roads and trees activist in rural Devon. Andy got his doctorate in the UK at the University of East Anglia. After research in Canada, Ridgewell became a professor at the University of California, Riverside. He specializes in biogeochemical modeling and climate change. Andy Ridgewell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I didn't actually know that you would dig up my long-ago previous history as a tree hugger.
No tree hugger gets off without being mentioned here. We love tree huggers. Okay, so now, I think this paper is a breakthrough. Why don't we start? What was the situation here on Earth before the PETM event? What was it like?
Hot. Sea level was high. There were no ice sheets. A friend, previous colleague, now unfortunately deceased, once to the New York Times when pressed on, what was it like, what was it like, what was it like? He said it was hot as hell and there were mosquitoes the size of your head. I think the size of your head, but it's not quite correct, but hot as hell.
Right, so it started from a very hot position, and without going into the causes yet, how do we know there was a big, fast warming around 56 million years ago, even from that hot point?
That's a good question. So, I mean, the instrumental record stretches back to the 1800s, and we're looking back now 55 million years, so we have no thermometers or anything like that. Dinosaurs have been dead by 10 million years, so we're at least post the big asteroid impact. We have to resort to a whole bunch of tools that involve lots of careful and high-tech lab work, which I don't actually do myself. I leave all that hard work to others. There are changes in the ratio between different elements recorded in microscopic shells that settle to the bottom of the ocean. You can drill down into the mud at the bottom of the ocean. You can find these tiny organisms, or the shells of them, called foraminifera. One of the things that people look at is the ratio between magnesium and calcium, and that changes as a function of the temperature they grow in. Another thing that changes as a function of the temperature they grow in is oxygen isotopes. So now you're measuring the same element, oxygen, but you're looking at the ratio between different masses. People have got increasingly clever. There are bugs that live in the ocean which adjust the fluidity of their cell membrane according to temperature. And some of these compounds are preserved in the sediments, and so you can measure the different compounds. There's some more things like this. So there are a whole variety of different, we call them proxies, because we don't have a direct measure of ancient temperature, but we have some measure that we can relate to temperature. There are a whole bunch of different measures, and they all give a sort of consistent 4 to 6 degrees of global warming across this event.
Now, before I ran into your paper, scientists had suggested that methane clathrates were the most likely cause of this heating event called the PETM, and so we should worry about clathrates today. What does your new research show as the main cause of that warming event?
You're right that hydrates, methane hydrates, or clathrates are also called. That was the most popular hypothesis. We can maybe talk about, if you like, later, you know, implications or not implications for the future. Also, people wondered whether there was a lot of organic matter on land that then got oxidized with this warming and helped amplify the event. We found it was more likely to be mostly driven by volcanism. So right at this time, the North Atlantic starts to rapidly rift apart. So Greenland is being moved away from the UK and Scandinavia. There are massive flood basalts. There are intrusions of magma into oil traps, into coal measures. There's a whole variety of sort of exciting sort of petrological and volcanological sort of things going on, all of which that could lead to the release of CO2 to the atmosphere.
And we've seen, though, that one major volcano erupting can cool the Earth for a couple of years. The eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in 1991 cooled it by about 1 degree Fahrenheit, I'm told. And in 1815, we had that Indonesian volcano dropping temperatures several degrees. So why would volcanic eruptions that you're talking about lead to global warming in the PETM?
So that's a good point. The sulfate aerosols that some volcanoes put up high into the stratosphere. So firstly, you need a very explosive eruption to push it. So sulfate aerosols lower down are no good. That's what sort of comes out of a lot of marine shipping at the moment. That just leads, at least today, to smog and not to necessarily cooling. You've got to put this stuff up about 30 or 40 kilometers into the atmosphere where the little particles reflect sunlight. But these effects don't last that long. So Pinatubo was a measurable sort of cooling for about a year or so. And then the sulfate aerosols basically eventually rain out on a timescale of a few years. Whereas we know if you put CO2 in the atmosphere, this is with us for, it has a range of timescales, but it's effectively with us for tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of years.
So global warming gases come up out of those volcanoes from the depths of the Earth?
Yes. So that's one. So magma, the Earth has a lot of dissolved CO2 in the interior of the Earth. And so as you bring magma to the surface and it depressurizes, that CO2 can come out. So that's a basic effect of what volcanism can do with greenhouse gases. You can get magma up on the surface, but you don't. You can intrude magma horizontally, and these are called sills. And often the magma is pushing between different sorts of rock, which is maybe a weak layer there. And if it pushes, for instance, above or below a coal measure, then it's going to cook up that coal, and it's going to release CO2 that way. So we see evidence of these sort of magmatic, horizontal magmatic intrusions contacting with coal measures around about the time of the PETM. We also see evidence for this sort of magmatic activity meeting basically fossil fuel reserves at the end of a period called the Permian, which is where almost all life died out. That was 251 million years ago.
Now, how did you work out that it was not thawing methane clathrates or hydrates that caused the great warming?
So this comes back to what a lot of my colleagues do with taking the sediment that's been drilled from the bottom of the ocean and trying to fish out these tiny, tiny, they're about 200-300 microns across, these little shells of zooplankton that were living close to the surface of the ocean back 55 million years ago. There's another element called boron. This goes into a lot of cleaning products and washing powders and detergents today. This also has two isotopes, and that ratio changes not like temperature, which oxygen isotopes we use for temperature, but for boron, the two isotopes change in their ratio as they're recorded in the foraminifer as a function of pH, so the acidity of the ocean. So my colleagues reconstructed basically how the pH of the surface ocean changed across this event, and then I used a computer model of the global carbon cycle to match that pH change to the carbon emissions, and the result was that the carbon emissions were much too large to be things like hydrates, or at least not hydrates alone.
Now, considering how rapidly we're warming now, it is important to know how fast the warming was 56 million years ago. And along with Sandra Kirtland-Turner of UC Riverside, you co-authored what I would call a companion piece in Nature Communications on August 25th, and the title is A Probabilistic Assessment of the Rapidity of PETM Onset. Can you give us a snapshot of what that article outlines?
So that other study, so this looks at some, we're back to these tiny shells again of these zooplankton called foraminifera. That looks at some data, quite old data now, where people measured single shells, and they saw a lot of values. One of the proxies they measured was temperature, so they had a lot of values that were colder temperatures, so before this warming event. And then there appeared to be this sudden transition, or at least the next set of samples they measured all appeared to have the warm temperatures of during the event, or the peak of the event. And they didn't measure any what one could call intermediate values. So if you had a very, very slow warming, for instance, you would start measuring in the very deepest sediments, you would start measuring cold temperatures. And then if you had a very, very slow warming event, you would start measuring slightly warmer temperatures, slightly warmer temperatures, slightly warmer temperatures again in these oxygen isotopes until you eventually are measuring the peak warming temperatures. But that's not what was seen in this record. They had cold temperatures and then straight to hot temperatures. And so this was a sort of statistical model looking at how these shells might have been moved around in the sediments by a process called bioturbation, and trying to come up with a probabilistic estimate of what is the chance, given a certain assumed warming, assumed warming rate, what is the chance of not measuring one of these intermediate values.
So, Andy Ridgewell, in March 2016, you co-authored the paper published in Nature Geoscience titled Anthropogenic Carbon Release Rate, Unprecedented During the Past 66 Million Years. The review article by Turner et al. Says your newest paper this year found peak carbon emission rates during the PETM were less than a tenth of current fossil fuel emissions, and yet there was a warming of 5 degrees C. What does that tell us?
That's a difficult question in terms of the two aspects of this whole thing. Firstly, I've actually been on a number of papers that have come to all sorts of conclusions about the rate of warming or the time scale for this event onset. And I think we still have very little constraints on whether it was, you know, between about 1 and 10 or so thousand years. We can do different techniques like this probabilistic assessment to come up with less than 3 or 4, but you can look at some other methods and maybe come up with 3 or more. So the first thing is it's a very uncertain estimate to make. Time is very, very difficult in geology, other than the sort of very, very longest multi-million year sort of timescales. In terms of what we can learn about the future, what the relevance is, given that we're doing something so much faster. So let's say that we saw on a very slow warming, so across the PETM of 5 degrees, let's say we saw no extinction in polar bears. Now, polar bears probably haven't evolved by then. Does that mean that polar bears are safe today? We got a much faster warming, so it's difficult. It doesn't mean they're safe, and it doesn't mean they're not safe. That is one of the problems of drawing inferences from a slow event to a fast event. If we see a lack of impact, we can't rule that out for the future. Certainly, if we saw things happen at the PETM, we can say we will have it at least as bad in the future. I mean, one thing we do see is extinctions amongst some of these little shells in the deep sea. Whether anyone cares about in the future, I doubt it. But that does suggest that if we have some sort of extinction impact at the PETM, we should have that and more with a faster event in the future. Because no one cares about the deep sea, we do know that there was massive reorganization and disruption in terrestrial ecosystems, so we should expect something at least on that scale. There were actually good things from the PETM, so there was a big mammalian radiation, and things like horses basically evolved after the PETM. So warming can be a good thing, depending on whether the other species that goes extinct or not.
Yes, and we hope not to be one of those species that goes extinct, and we don't know that yet. Okay, but my understanding is that the PETM warming began, as you said, when Earth was already ice-free at the poles. Isn't it likely that the energy required to melt Greenland and Antarctica could slow down the pace of warming at our time, despite emissions being much higher? I mean, it takes a lot of juice to melt that ice.
It does. Compared with the energy released by fossil fuels is a lot, but not compared with the free energy we get by trapping more infrared radiation that's trying to escape the Earth. I can't remember whether I've ever tried to do that back-of-the-envelope calculation. It's an interesting question, whether if you were going to take the energy from the Earth's surface to melt all the ice caps over 10 years or 100 years, what would that represent in terms of a delayed warming or reduced warming? I don't know, but it's not like putting ice cubes in your beer. It's not going to help us much, I think. It's in climate models, so the predictions within climate models include snow melt or snow not being formed, and some of them increasingly have a coupled ice sheet model, so they would account for whatever that slight energy balance change is, but it's not a lot, and it's not going to keep us cool.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock as we investigate what brought on the last big global warming event 56 million years ago. My guest is Professor Andy Ridgewell from the University of California. He's co-author of a new paper which says basically the volcanoes did it. And I'd like to note that this new science of the PETM was led by Dr. Marcus Gutjahr of the Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research in Kiel, Germany. And I'm drawing from a commentary on this paper, Andy, that was published in Nature August 31st. You pointed me to it. The lead author is Katrin J. Meissner from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. The title is Volcanism Caused Ancient Global Warming. There's a cool graphic that helps compare the two scenarios of methane versus volcanism. Can the techniques you used pick up a big burst of carbon over a very short period, like decades, if seabed methane did in fact erupt?
No.
Okay.
So, I mean, the data we got so far is at the cutting edge of the mass spectrometric techniques, but the data are quite sparse in time, or if you'd like to think of the sediment core as distance, they're relatively sparse in terms of going up the sediment core. So things could be happening in between those data points that we don't know about. The same total carbon release over a timescale of X could be short bursts of carbon over much shorter intervals with a gap in between. We can't rule that out. We can certainly rule out that happened with short bursts and nothing in between, and it was all hydrates. So I didn't mention it earlier. So when we measured this proxy using the boron isotopes to try and reconstruct ocean surface pH, we also measured at the same time carbon isotopes. And carbon isotopes can be used to pinpoint the source of your carbon. So we're using boron isotopes to reconstruct pH, and from pH tell us how much carbon was released. And then we look at the carbon isotopes to tell us what sort of carbon. And the combination of those two proxies tells us it must be mostly volcanism. We could certainly have small bursts of methane, but the whole event has to be driven to satisfy both these proxy constraints, both these reconstructed records. The whole event, the event as a whole, has to be mostly volcanism.
Did this study add anything to our understanding of climate sensitivity?
Well, the model that I developed and used to calculate the global carbon cycle impacts and to take the data and come out with estimates of carbon release and also the source of that carbon is not a full climate model. So it does assume inherently that you know what climate sensitivity is. And we assumed about 3 degrees, which is about the median of what we're expecting today. So the modeling itself didn't really have a freedom to tell you what climate sensitivity might be. I mean, certainly given that we have estimates of the carbon release, and hence we have estimates of how much atmospheric CO2 rose, and we have independent estimates of how temperature changed, you could certainly make that calculation. The answer is about 3 degrees. But it's not something that we really wanted to try and make something of. So at least what we've done without trying to say anything about climate sensitivity seems consistent with a middle-of-the-road sort of IPCC consensus number.
Now, you mentioned seabed life having problems. How did the oceans and ocean life respond to that wave of carbon and gases descending from volcanic dust?
So because on almost any of the estimates of timescale you take, this event is 1,000 to many thousands of years long in terms of the warming completed, the ocean, at least in the model and some proxy data suggests there were changes in ocean circulation, but the deep ocean will warm not much lagged compared with the surface. What we're doing today is very unusual. It's a very rapid surface-driven warming. What happens then, it's like a little bit like a lake in summer. You tend to stratify the surface. You shut down ventilation temporarily. So today and continuing into the near future, we're stratifying the ocean. You reduce the nutrient supply to phytoplankton. You can sort of induce all sorts of biogeochemical changes and ecological changes. Probably at the PTM, because the warming seems so much slower, it was not so drastic in terms of ocean circulation. So at the bottom of the ocean, probably saw warming, maybe decreased pH as the thing that caused some of the extinctions.
And we're concerned too, Andy, about ocean acidification. Did that happen in that long ago warming event?
Well, in terms of just ocean pH itself, that's exactly what happened, because that's what we've reconstructed with these boron isotopes in these tiny foraminiferal shells. But what, in the modern ocean, what a lot of organisms seem to care about, and we care about corals, and so coral reefs become a big thing, corals are much more susceptible to not the ocean pH directly. This is where it all gets into miserable chemistry, into a part of the carbonate system called the carbonate ion. To cut a long story short, in a very short warming event driven by CO2 release like we're doing now, pH declines. Some organisms may be affected by pH. This carbonate ion species declines in concentration. This is what corals care about today and may be impacted by. If you go to a very slow carbon release, it turns out that those two things get decoupled. You see the pH change, and this is what we record, but the carbonate ion doesn't necessarily change very much. So it's a different sort of ocean acidification. If you think of ocean acidification only in terms of pH, yes, we have ocean acidification. If you think of ocean acidification as the total change to the carbonate system in the ocean due to releasing CO2, then it's very different at the PTM because of the relative slowness of the event.
And was this great event that happened 56 million years ago, was it also a mass extinction event on land?
So I'm not a terrestrial ecological expert. There were many disruptions, many range shifts because of the warming probably allowing species to mix across the Arctic. There were actually mammalian radiations, and actually sort of you could look at it, evolutionary positive things that came out of it. It may be that we don't have the records really to nail down extinctions on land. We're much more familiar with, funnily enough, we're much more familiar with these organisms that are 200 microns across. The record tends to be much more complete, and I guess we focus on the complete records with good timescales first.
And how long did those higher temperatures last, Andy?
Probably of the order of about 100,000 years, which is a typical lifetime of CO2. So if we stopped emitting CO2 tomorrow, the warming will last on the timescale of 100,000 years.
Now, a couple of scientists have suggested that it may be relatively good news to find out that volcanic activity caused the last great warming instead of methane clathrates or permafrost melting. Why?
And I think you could say they're right. So certainly when a lot of us were thinking a while ago that maybe it was things like hydrates. So we always knew the PTM, it needed some sort of trigger. And then what a lot of the thinking was that what we were seeing was positive feedbacks involving initial warming, maybe destabilizing methane hydrates, the methane causing more warming, maybe this warming also causing oxidation of organic matter in peatlands and carbon stores on land. And so this event did originally look like it could have been a smallish trigger with lots of positive feedbacks driving more and more warming. And the implications of that would be, might we not have this in the future? We know we have hydrates in the ocean today. We know we have lots of carbon in permafrost. We have carbon in wetlands. And so I think the concern originally was, or a concern was, if we had such a strong, it's called a feedback, if we had such a strong positive feedback between warming and carbon release at the PTM, maybe this is what we'll end up triggering in the future. So if it's largely volcanism, which is what we concluded, you can rule out such a strong feedback back then, although you can't necessarily rule such a strong feedback out now starting from a cold climate state.
Yeah, I wonder what the crowd at the Arctic Methane Emergency Group will make of this. Have you had any of the scientists who considered methane the prime cause of the PETM commenting on your new science?
Not yet, not to me. So I'm not the first author of the study, so I let the first author take all the incoming.
The heat, so to speak.
Yeah.
All right. Now, I'm wondering, Andy Ridgewell, what are some of your other interests, both personally and as a scientist?
Cats. Writing about computer code. Scientifically, I'm interested actually in all of science. So writing computer models, learning to code and write computer models actually gives you the option to look at all sorts of things. If you can write some sort of computing numerical representation of a system, then you can look at it. I have tended to focus on the global carbon cycle, but in writing models that you can put new things in, different things, I can look at all sorts of different time periods. I've looked at geoengineering. I've had students who've looked at, funny enough, putting sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
I think it makes a cooling. whether we should do it is, I think the mistake often is to think you can solve everything with a single solution or a single idea. There is this concept which has been around for a while in terms of climate mitigation called wedges. No one doesn't replace their incandescent light bulbs with LED bulbs because it's not going to solve the entire climate problem. You know it's a small part of the piece. So you change your mode of transport, you use more energy-efficient devices. My personal view is I'm not adverse to a little bit of geoengineering if it's part of a, you know, if it gets us there in terms of mitigating climate change or reducing climate change.
I suppose one of my questions would be, you've looked into this great warming event and a good many other things. What are your feelings about the direction we're heading now? I mean, for example, you mentioned 3 degrees. That's, I believe, the figure if we double the carbon from pre-industrial levels. I've seen people discussing a lot more than that, including scientists. There was the 4 degrees and beyond conferences, two of those. So what is your general take about the direction we're going?
I was optimistic before the price of oil plummeted beneath 100 and then beneath 50. And I'm still waiting for, I had hoped, we were meant to have hit peak oil a while ago, but we clearly haven't done. So one thing that could have been helping us, but it just hasn't panned out that way with oil shale and things like that, is just the price of oil being at a value. It's meant to be something like $150 or so a barrel, long enough that basically it's just more profitable to do renewable energy. You know, at some point, as long as fossil fuel energy is sufficiently expensive, no one wants to lose money on their coal-burning power station. Everyone switches to renewables because that's how you make money. So it's unfortunate to be thinking about future climate change with oil at, I can't remember if it's like 40 or whatever it is now. It seems like suddenly we're back to pessimism days of we're going to keep burning it, we're going to keep burning it, we're going to keep burning it. I'd like to think we head back up to 100, 150, and then we start seeing a further push towards renewables and everyone driving electric cars and things.
Well, there is that bright light. I believe the UK and several other governments have set a date beyond which they just aren't going to allow fossil-burning cars on the roadways, for example. But there's so much more to the whole system than that. We've got carbon coming out of agriculture, carbon coming out of everything, it seems like.
And at some point, you'll probably see it mandated from the White House that everyone has to have a coal-burning car, probably, at this rate here.
Maybe we'll leave it there. The coal-burning car, I'm all in favor. Okay, we've been talking with Dr. Andy Ridgewell from the University of California, Riverside. He's co-author of an important new paper in the journal Nature titled Very Large Release of Mostly Volcanic Carbon During the Paleo-Eocene Thermal Maximum. And you can find links to the articles I've talked about here, plus more science journalism about this paper, in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.org. Andy, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks, my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Let's not forget, most of the already dire predictions still do not include the soil carbon feedback. Our guest in December 2016, Thomas Crowther, explained it.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Now, to be clear, in this paper, when you discuss 1 degree C of warming over 35 years to 2050, are you assuming 1 degree above pre-industrial temperature of the planet or 1 degree hotter than we are now?
That would be 1 degree hotter than we are now. But that's not what we're predicting. That's the most sort of recent ensemble member of the Earth system model suggests that soil temperature, surface soil temperature is going to go up by 2 degrees by that time. So it's closer to an order of magnitude of 55 petagrams by 2050. We'll be lost from the carbon.
Can you please explain why the effects of a given amount of warming are never fully realized?
So ultimately, the process is always acting in response to warming. So the warming takes place, and then it's within the next couple of years that ultimately the total extent of carbon emissions takes place. So it's never an immediate process. And so it's almost like the changes in carbon emissions are always following the changes in warming.
Okay. So since more carbon from soils will increase warming, we call this a positive feedback loop. Are there control factors which can slow or halt this extra carbon release from the soil?
Certainly. There's a lot of evidence suggesting that changes to agricultural practices, things like holistic management of grazing animals or, you know, the use of biochar or organic products can lead to massive scale carbon sequestration. And this has the potential to dampen the feedback that we're talking about here. And, you know, if done on a global scale, I think it has a really good, a strong chance to put a major dent in the magnitude of these carbon losses.
Now, media reports say this added soil carbon could be equal to adding another United States in terms of emissions. I had a question about that. Does that mean 1 year of U.S. emissions could come from the soil by 2050, or that every year soils could release the same amount as the United States does now?
So I think the article that highlighted that was suggesting that it would be every year the soils will emit as much as the United States is doing now. I think it was calculated more roughly, though, based on we estimated that the carbon emissions from the soil are going to be approximately equivalent to 17% of current anthropogenic emissions, well, expected anthropogenic emissions over that time. So every year, humans will emit a certain amount, and then the soil will be responsible for an extra 17%. Whereas at the moment, the U.S. is also 17% of the total anthropogenic emissions. So it's really just sort of on that same order of magnitude. Every year, the soils will emit almost as much, well, about equivalent amounts of carbon that we expect to be emitted from the U.S.
It's like adding a new giant industrialized country just because of this new knowledge. Thomas Crowther, I know it's exciting to discover results in science, but this is really bad news heaped on already bad news. Does it bother you?
I have to admit, sometimes it does. I really, you know, of course I want to understand the world, and if that understanding of the world can bring some sad news, then certainly it's not always enjoyable. And it seems very strange when you sort of celebrate a big discovery, but that discovery is about something so catastrophic for potentially for humanity. You know, it's a really serious impact. But what I would stress is that I do certainly see the positive side of this. I think if we're going to fight against something as considerable as climate change, the first thing we need to do is understand how considerable it's going to be. And once we get a handle on future climate conditions, and once we understand what the climate's going to do, it's only then that we can really set meaningful targets to fight against it. So I like to believe that this is certainly contributing to our fight against climate change.
That was Dr. Thomas Crowther from the Netherlands Institute of Ecology, as broadcast on Radio EcoShock on December 14th, 2016. You can find all our past shows for free as downloads in the archives at ecoshock.org, and you'll find my notes on this week's interviews with V. Ramanathan and Andy Ridgewell in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Check it out.
Radio EcoShock.
We're out of time for this show, and for climate action a few years from now, it's well past now or never. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our world.
Normal is what she's not. I just changed this thing.